Welcome to Conscious Curiosity SD, where successful San Diego leaders share their stories of leading beyond profit and are using the influence of business to positively change the companies and communities we all work and live in. I'm your host, Jeff Blanta from Jailbreak Leadership, a proven and powerful process for unlocking the full potential of the people and teams across your organization, giving you the competitive advantage in the marketplace. We want to thank our collaborative community of business organizations, the Better Business Bureau, Conscious Capitalism, Business for Good, Cause San Diego, and Be Local. We're all focused on impacting our community of San Diego through the work they do as business leaders. Welcome to the show.
From purposeful idea to revenues in the mid eight figures to selling to a strategic buyer is what business dreams are made of, but rarely happen. But today, that's our guest story, and she's here to share it with you. Jenna Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Jenna was the co-founder of Eucora. Eucora addresses UTIs, urinary tract infections, from end to end, from symptom relief products to proactive care supplements. Eucora has helped hundreds of thousands of people get on top of their urinary health. From idea to sale, Jenna is here to share the secret sauce of the ultimate business success. You ready, Jenna?
Let's do it.
All right. Why did you decide to jump into this thing? What was the passion that brought you into this particular business? Behind the story.
Sure. Yeah. I was a patient before I was a founder. Not an uncommon story in women's health. Had always struggled with UTIs, but it got to a particularly bad point in 2014. I had 8 UTIs and knew that I was frustrated with my options, especially for prevention. Antibiotics are great for treatment, but they lead to other issues. And so if you're in a cycle where you're taking antibiotics 8 or 9 times a year, you're sort of constantly in a cycle where your body is struggling to get even footing. So started to experiment and look into research for ways to get ahead of urinary tract infections.
Thank goodness for the internet, huh?
Goodness for the internet. And in this case, my then boyfriend, now husband, Spencer, my co-founder. So his background is in—
That's a whole other story.
Yeah. Yep. His background is in molecular biology. And so together we started to look into what was available from universities and hospitals and found there was good disparate research on different ingredients that wasn't really being connected at that time. It was really just cranberry was sort of the party line. And, you know, some people have had some success. The research often isn't there. And I had never found success with cranberry. So that was sort of the landscape that we were working with and started really just experimenting. And with N of one, found success and started to go from there.
You were the lab rat, huh?
Exactly. Exactly. And at that time, I knew that I needed a better solution, but didn't know how common UTIs were. And they're super common.
What are the numbers?
They're the second most common infection in the U.S., second only to the common cold.
And so on average, is it like 1 out of 5?
It's always been hard to get the population stats because the CDC doesn't track them in that way. And there's a lot of recurrent UTIs. So the stats you'll find is like one that we reference the most was 10 million UTIs a year. But it was always tricky to know. It was like, is there a bunch of Jennas out there having 8 UTIs? And is that being counted?
Right.
But the punchline is it's common. And once you get into this world, you really find it. So it's sort of the data that is available shows at least 10 million UTIs a year in the U.S., second most common infection, second to the common cold, and then actually most common bacterial infection, which is astounding based on how infrequently people discuss UTIs. And there's a lot of reason behind that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's not your classic cocktail hour.
Well, for me, it became that, but yeah, it's right. True. That
so you're doing your research, right?
Exactly.
But it is kind of interesting. Just about anything like that, right? You go, well, this is probably isn't something we want to talk about. When you bring it up, everybody goes, oh yeah, I got a brother, I got a sister, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And way more brothers and dads and uncles than you would think. You know, UTIs get really kind of characterized as a young woman's sexual problem. And of course, there is that population, no doubt. And that was sort of the water I was swimming in at that time. But a lot of women get UTIs for the first time postmenopause, and then it becomes really common for men as prostate issues continue.
Still got something to look forward to here.
Exactly. And by the time you're kind of in that 65 plus range, the gender balance really sort of settles and it's people of both men and female are getting a lot of UTIs. Anyway, went deep there. The point is, it's common. And when we started to realize how common it was. We're just
making sure the audience, we're talking to them, right? If you don't have one, you might get one. So pay attention.
If you haven't had one, be afraid. So, you know, went from there, started with one product and eventually kind of rolled out a suite of preventative products that helped.
So that's where you started with on the prevention side?
Yes. Yes. Okay. And that remained our focus throughout our time at Eucora. We did end up releasing sort of some different OTC products for symptom management, but it was never our bread and butter. And it really wasn't like where the passion was. There's decent products like that already and they had existed. But there weren't preventative products that could really help people break that cycle of recurrent UTI. So that was always where we focused.
So how did you go from N of one in the kitchen, making up some brew or whatever with your now husband to like, oh, let's turn this into a business. I mean, how did that evolve?
Yeah. So we started with just sort of a soft launch. It was more of a moonlight affair. We launched the product on Shopify. And this was for the first time.
Farmers markets or whatever.
No, we were always e-commerce. So my husband's background is in molecular biology. And my background is in e-commerce and way too many UTIs. So that was sort of our combination of our starter kit of, you know, qualifications, if you will. And so e-commerce was the place for us to start. And we did find that people were finding us online on their own with very, very little marketing or fanfare.
Because people like you are looking.
There was a need. And although that was, of course, exciting, and at that point we were still living our day jobs and this was running in the background, what really gave us the confidence to go from N of one to, you know, where we ended up going is that people were repeat buying the products, even though we weren't doing anything to make that easy for them or educate them on how the product was working or anything like that. So that was sort of
You proved the model. You proved we got a product.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how did you manufacture this? I mean, how did that come to be? Because that's often a big challenge.
Yeah. And it always was, you know, a part of the business that required a lot of kind of experimentation and relationship building, et cetera. But we always used co-manufacturers. We developed the formula and were very involved in the supply chain aspect of it, but always outsourced the actual manufacturing.
Oh, locally here though, like in San Diego area or?
Of our three flagship products, two of them were manufactured locally for majority of the time we were running the business. Unfortunately, we reached a threshold that they couldn't support anymore and ended up needing to move to Coman in New Jersey. And they ended up doing a lot for us.
That's a good problem.
It was. It was a sad problem, though, because, yeah, you know, right. To the point of like nurturing the San Diego ecosystem, we cared about the fact that we were able to stay local. And it was very fun to be able to pop down and sort of do some of that quality control yourself and just meet with the people who are making it happen day to day. We were so appreciative to our partners for sure.
That's a question I have for you. So, I mean, at some level, this kind of falls in that idea of the supplements or whatever area where people always go, well, it's not FDA approved or whatever. So how do you kind of prove the quality of the product and ensure that things are happening the way you want them to happen?
Well, quality co-mans will meet all these standards and more depending on who you choose. So it was always important to us that they were following the good manufacturing practices, which is a, you know, sort of a specific qualifications of right. How they maintain integrity and cleanliness and all of this. And then, you know, it's about just ensuring that they're up to date on all their certificates and all their annual permitting and everything like this. A lot of co-manufacturers will go even above and beyond what's required of them. And that was something we looked for.
Right. So how did you manage to blow this thing up into the big business that it was? Like, what's the secret sauce? That's what everybody wants to know, right?
Yeah. And of course, everyone wants a silver bullet story. And really, it's always multifaceted. But I think what started everything, and we've been talking actually about products. So I'll just make the mention that if these products weren't efficacious to begin with, we wouldn't be here. Nothing else I'm about to say would matter. So what really, you know, all of our success is built on is the fact that these products gave people breakthrough health and are continuing to do so. You know, Eucora is bigger than ever. I'm no longer running it, but the company is still thriving. So if it weren't the case that these products were able to unlock health for people in a different way, we would go nowhere. But what I think our secret sauce beyond just the formula was, is that it was founded by someone who totally understands sort of the more emotional side of being stuck in this quality of life problem that, like, for the most part won't kill you, you know, unless you're much older. This is actually a huge problem in kind of hospice populations and senior care centers. And that statement doesn't always apply. But for the most part, people are finding they can carry on, but it becomes a huge emotional tax to feel like you're always anxious about when your next UTI is going to happen. And it can be a lonely journey. So in some cases,
speaking from experience,
right. Yeah. So it, even though started with the perspective of sort of my own experience, I had to really expand the fact that my experience doesn't apply to everyone's who has UTIs. People get them for all different reasons, different times, all different ages. But the commonality is that you're just so relieved to get a break from this sort of both physical and emotional toll of staying stuck in a cycle. So always took that very seriously in how we talk to our customers. We were a compassion first organization. We built a very robust customer success team with the intention of having as much time as we need to talk to customers, even the ones who actually just want to talk about their UTI journey. And so for some people, they'd talk to our customer success team and it would, you know, kind of border into a therapy session of the first time they've been able to talk about sort of the emotional toll. And so that kind of started to build our scaffolding of this premise that we want to leave everyone better than we found them at Eucora. Even if they are only a prospect who never becomes a customer, even if they're a customer who doesn't stick with the product long-term, we want it to be a positive experience.
So how did you build that team? I mean, that's tough to find. I just left here to have lunch and bought a sandwich. And the girl that took my money, I'm like going, and it's her first day or whatever. But I'm like going, this is not the right job for her. She just had like no personality, no nothing. I'm like going.
Well, I kind of think you talk about this premise a lot on your podcast in different ways, that there is just so many people who want their work to matter. And I've found that there was always an amazing candidate pool of people who wanted their job to be helping people. And Eucora, I think, had this really like kind of beautiful confluence of factors that allowed that to be the case. You know, if you cared about that and you're an empath by nature, you get to have these breakthrough conversations with people and help understand what they need. But aside from that, you could also join a startup environment where we're growing fast and right. have some of these trappings that, you know, you might think of more as sort of like a tech environment. And so I found it easy to find those people because they were finding us. And, you know, we did a lot. I cared a lot about people in general. That was both our team and our customers. And we did a lot to make it a good place to work. So not only were we able to find these people, but in the time that I had been with Eucora from starting to the time that I stepped out of the business upon acquisition, we'd only ever had one person leave the customer success team.
Oh, wow.
Which is not the normal attrition stat in customer success. So
yeah, it's a tough space to work, right?
Right. Yeah.
Talking to customers all day, people either complaining about their issues or whatever. So.
Sure. Sure.
So did you do like any kind of filtering of like testing or something of your people, you know, to try and figure out if they had the right traits or just basically a conversation with them or?
Yeah, not necessarily testing. I think customer success in particular is often entry level. And so, you know, it's a little bit less formulaic than if you were to do something more STEM related or something where that might be a good filter.
Yeah.
But we had a few things we would do in the recruitment process. We, first of all, would always blind names. We did a good amount of like blinding in the application process and would have 5 questions that people had to answer upon applying. And that was really useful in kind of getting a sense for both the soft skills that are going to be required and just, are you like well-written and a clear communicator? That's really important in the customer success world we were doing. But the questions would often be kind of related to like, what motivates you? And sort of like,
you have an example of the 5 questions? People?
I'm trying to remember. I think it was like a, what motivates you? Tell us about a time you were able to explain something to someone in a way that like changed their thinking. Sort of education-based questions was important for customer success. And then what environment do you strive in? They were always very like growth mindset oriented questions to see if people were able to answer those in a way that made it clear that they were like caring about this job, but also thinking about how they fit into the ecosystem.
Right. And we're trying to grow a business over here. And do you want to be part of this journey? And
yes. Yeah. Yes.
Might need a little bit more from you than you would the job down the street kind of idea.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I was part of a startup many years ago and I was interviewing kind of from my management team and I had a whiteboard in my office. And I remember one of my things was, here's your great opportunity, right? I'd have the whiteboard be blank. I go, you've done a lot of things, right? Gone into companies and this is how we do stuff. Here's your opportunity to come in and do it the way you want to do it, right? Yeah. Everyone went, yeah. I want to sign up for this, right?
Awesome.
Yeah, because you're getting to create something new, right? Now we're going to tap into your expertise and what you thought was right. All the things you complained about before, now you get to be that people would complain about you now instead of you complain about them, whatever, but you get to own this, right?
Oh, and it's a filter. There's some people I think who would find that blank space frightening and not excited about sort of being the owner of
destiny.
You should
be in a startup then, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we're trying to build something over here. It's going to be crazy.
Exactly.
Well, I love that. I love that. So obviously customer service was key. Anything else that was key to success?
Yes. Customer service was key. I think that was important to stay true to the feeling that like we care about your, we're invested personally in your journey. Another element of it is we always led with the founding story. I think that was disarming to people to see this chick on TV talking about UTIs. People aren't talking about UTIs even at cocktail parties like you're mentioning. So it was kind of this element of like, look, I've been there. Here's
sense of being real.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And really, this isn't, I think, a novel concept in the like the e-commerce world, but like people want to buy products from people, not a faceless organization. And so that's always a compelling proposition to feel like you understand like who is behind this company.
Were your products such that you needed to get some information? Like we give you product A, B, or C? Was there like some sorting through what you would actually provide for someone?
For most people, our three preventative products worked best together.
And okay, so combo.
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah, almost 3/4 of people would buy the products as a regimen. But there was some sorting. It wouldn't always be right and people would make choices on their own. But for the most part, that sort of funnel was pretty clear of where you end up. But, you know, I'd say sort of the third pillar of what made us success and for Eucora and had us grow the way we grew is that we were able to really get the word out in the marketing sense. And I think that this is something, customer acquisition is a challenge for every organization. And we figured out early on that aside from the digital realm, which was where every e-commerce brand was at that time, Meta and Facebook, just to put us in time now, I'm really talking about 2017, 2018 is when we launched the business officially, which that matter, like the vintage year of Meta and Google matters so much to people in the business in part because there's this adage of like, the era before you got there was always the easy era, which I think is like a little bit true. But when we were there, we were looking back on the 2014s and being like, man, you could just spend pennies. And
if only.
But people listening to this now would definitely look at 2017, 2018 and have a similar narrative, whether that's right or not. But at that time, everyone in the e-commerce world was starting on Meta and Google and having that be the majority of their ad spend. And that was a component for us from the start. But we early on got the sense that if we could get out in front of people at the right cost, we would naturally be able to find tons of people who have UTIs. I can't target you based on because you liked Lululemon on Facebook, you might also like Eucora. Right. There was no other corollary like that.
No dots connected.
Exactly. Yeah. It was just kind of a numbers game. And this led us to placing a bet on FM radio. And
really? Yeah,
yes. Pretty random. At the time, the CPMs were super low. It was a dollar CPM. By the time I was stepping out of the business, we're triple that, maybe a little more. So it was a little bit of a moment in time thing. But we worked with this fantastic agency that would get us access to local remnant inventory, which means whatever ad space FM station hadn't sold in wherever, you know, Little Rock, Arkansas. I remember having like some air there.
Because your customers are everywhere,
they're
right?
Everywhere, yeah. Then we would like last minute slot our radio ad into that. And that worked well. We started seeing customers come in at the cost that we needed it to work out right away. And that grew our business significantly as soon as we'd started doing that. So ultimately, we weren't able to acquire as many customers on radio as we would need to over time for that to remain like a really important channel. But it was this huge watershed moment for us to understand that offline media works really well for us in a way that our peers weren't really doing. It's a little bit old fashioned. So we moved from there to what's called linear TV, which is cable TV, not streaming. And we're able to do the same thing there and scale significantly. So as time went on, digital channels mattered a lot for us. They were about 50% of our customer acquisition, but the offline channels mattered about as much. And at times were actually a much bigger part of that pie. But what was really peaceful about that is when, you know, the iOS 14 update hurt a lot of advertisers in the digital space. And in some cases, it closed businesses. And we were able to really kind of weather these different digital titans of industries fighting.
But I like the idea that you got creative, right? Mm-hmm. Looked at some old ways of doing things a little different than everyone else in the crowd was doing out here and found it to be effective for your product.
Exactly. And, you know, I would give San Diego a nod for that. I should mention that we were actually living in the Bay Area when we first started experimenting with Eucora. Yeah. So like, who leaves the Bay Area to grow their startup? Well, we did. And I'm so grateful we did, because it allowed us to kind of take a step back from the rat race,
the bubble, the that's norm. Up there.
Yes. Where especially, I think that there's been a little bit of a reckoning on this in the venture capital space, but especially at that time, I think people were confusing vanity metrics with success. And there was a lot of hoopla around how much money you could raise. And if you raised a big enough round, you know, you considered that you'd already succeeded, even though that didn't mean you had a business that was working well. Right. So moving down here, I think allowed us to kind of put us on an e-commerce island a bit in a way, but plugged us into this wonderful entrepreneurship ecosystem where I think people are just required to think a bit more out of the box, because it's a different landscape in San Diego. And I think that benefited us greatly.
So how did you fund this little venture of yours?
Yeah, we bootstrapped the business to start, which meant about 20K of which ultimately financed our first batch of inventory and our website. And basically that was it. And
how much product did that make?
Wow, it must have been, it was like 8,500 units.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think that was the minimum order quantity. It might've been 5K. But it was certainly the minimum we could find.
Right, right. Hopefully this works, right? We're going to have my garage full of
them. That was a wild ride. I mean, thinking about how we got to move up the chain with co-manufacturers as time went on was wonderful, because thank goodness there are the manufacturers out there who are willing to take small order quantities, but sometimes you pay for it in all these other ways. So it's nice to get to graduate from there.
Yeah, you start to learn all these new ecosystems that are out there, right?
Yes. And so from there, we raised, over the course of the next 18 months, 120K of friends and family money. A lot of that came from my coworkers at my previous business. I worked at DocuSign before Eucora, and amazingly, some of my coworkers believed in this business before they had a right to, family as well. But, you know, family, they love you. It's confusing.
So how scary was that to go out and ask for money amongst the family and friends?
It was pretty
I think that
tough.
Takes a certain level of being able to do that.
Yes.
I mean, I'm a guy that doesn't like ask for help. So the idea of going and asking for money seems like very daunting to me.
Yeah. You know, I think it was very tough, but it's also a forcing function. Once you've taken that plunge, you can't get off the ride. Right. Yeah. So I think that it was a necessary evil and felt that way. But, you know, actually our next chunk of money we got outside of that friend and family money was from winning a pitch competition actually at Hera Hub, which was an amazing experience. We won this local pitch competition, which I kind of went to on a whim, didn't plan to, and got selected to go to the national level and won 30K of non-dilutive capital from the Sarah Blakely Foundation, which was the first money we got that wasn't from someone I knew personally pretty well. And that was what we rolled directly into the radio test. It felt like such a big risk. It was going to be hard to take that risk with friends and family money. So I feel very grateful to this day of that difference of feeling of getting this bet you can place without sort of those strings attached.
But you obviously were telling a really good story.
And we'd already had growth. I think, you know, it was
a lot of times those pitches is still kind of like, oh, I got this idea versus, you know, actually out with some proof that we got something that works.
Yes. Yeah. It was a very clear premise. We always stuck to prevention as the thing we cared about in the UTI world. And aside from that, we started to have real month over month growth. So
focus is important too.
Focus is huge. I think that's the biggest challenge entrepreneurs face. But to complete that arc from there, that was really our watershed. We started to hit real growth that second year in business. We did over $1 million in revenue. And that was the year we actually were fundraising more out into kind of the small VCs, boutique family offices, that sort of realm. Ultimately, we raised $1.3 million at the end of that year and didn't get a lot of big VCs interested. And I'm very grateful for that in hindsight. We had more of kind of family offices, high net worth individuals, and they were very flexible in what our growth looked like from there on out. By that next year, which puts us at 2019, we were profitable and didn't need to raise again. And I felt very grateful to never have pressure to go out and raise a Series A. It would have really moved the goalpost for us, and we didn't need it. But sometimes, depending on who's in the mix, that can be the expectation. So got lucky on sort of having a brief funding story without too much pain in there.
Right. That can be an ongoing story of, diluting the company the whole time too, right?
Yes, very much.
So then you grew.
And we grew.
What does that story look like? You had to become a manager, right? Leader.
Yes, had to become a manager. So we grew. We grew after that first year. We'd 5X, then we 3X, then we 2.5X, stayed at that clip and continued to really, really enjoy that growth curve and that feeling of the next, you know, next milestone. And of course, that's an addicting feeling. That's the kind of sweet spot of entrepreneurship where you feel like you're always pushing toward that next thing. And yes, I had to become a manager, which was
SOPs
really...
SOPs and all that kinds of good stuff.
Yeah. And I always really loved that of it. I think we stayed lean. We didn't need a ton of people. And so by the time we were acquired, we were less than 20 people.
Okay. So that's highly manageable. Mm-hmm.
And that, I think of that as the golden era, you know, the everyone's rowing in the same direction without too much
drama,
hoopla. Yeah. You kind of like, of course you have to be articulating the goals clearly, but they also just kind of feel like the goals are just in the ether. It's just not that much opportunity for people to kind of like veer off course on.
And you're all at the same house toward. In the same location and all that.
Yes. We were at this time in Little Italy in an office that I love. And
how would you describe the culture there in this little team in Little Italy?
Fun, motivated. I think we were all extremely proud of the work we were doing and just enjoying this kind of upward trajectory.
What was the mix of men to women?
Well, pretty skewed towards women.
Okay. That's all right. If I was a bullet company, that's what I would do too. I'm just saying.
Well, yes, women's health company. I think a lot of women want to work at a women's health company.
I want to talk on the phone with a woman if I'm a woman, right?
Yeah. For sure. For sure. We did have men on the customer success team eventually, but yeah, there was a little bit of a hurdle there. And, you know, I think that just there was a sense of purpose of both. Like it was very clear that we were growing and what our goals were. And we were able to do it with a sense of win-win. We always felt like what we were doing growth-wise was clearly translating to people having breakthrough success with their health. And that feeling was like highly addicting. It just felt really great that there wasn't like a compromise here. It was really just every subscriber who stayed with the product for another month was reporting higher success. It felt like we were always trying to get repeat purchase rates up, subscription rate up. But that felt like completely just like for everyone's benefit. And I feel really grateful that I didn't have to have this kind of like Mr. Burns feeling from The Simpsons. It never felt like that. We weren't making trade-off decisions. We were making very compatible decisions is how it felt.
So it's great when you get that feedback loop like that. I think it's one of the challenges when companies start to grow and you start to have remote jobs. You know, I'm in the finance department, whatever. You're not connected to the customer stories or whatever. It's hard you lose track of like, oh, we're doing this really cool thing in the marketplace, but I never see it. Right. I never get to touch that. Right.
Right. Right.
So when everybody's kind of in that game with a team of 20 and that, you definitely, everybody's getting that feedback and it's powerful.
For sure. And so much credit to our customer on this. Our customers were constantly sharing their stories with us. Our reviews are insane.
This is what you were doing, right? You're changing lives.
Yes. All hands, we were able to have, you know, video. I mean, there was like always a moment where like there was just waterworks in the room, but it was usually because our customers would share a video testimonial with us, which for the first few years, I was afraid to ask any of our customers for testimonials because I felt like, I don't know, it's too personal. They wouldn't want to share this. And that was so
wrong.
Like actually they were just so excited to share kind of the impact Eucora had on their lives. And also, like I said, talk about sort of this journey that takes up a lot of headspace and you don't always have a platform for. And so that was a very fun way to even have, you know, like you said, the person in finance, the person in ops always, I think, felt pretty intimately linked to our customers because we were able to create that through line thanks to our customers' willingness to share.
So boyfriend, now husband, so the partnership, how did that all evolve and kind of your skill sets kind of very opposite or whatever? I mean, how did that all play out? The growing of the business.
I think that our skill sets aren't that opposite. We both kind of identify as generalists, though he has science expertise that I don't. So he was always our product guy, our R&D person, ran the clinical research we did and that side of the house. And I ran people, HR, that side of the house. And then everything in between, there was a lot of overlap on at different times.
Negotiated who was going to do what. Yeah. No, you got this.
But what I love about that is really aside from product, either my husband or I were on a certain segment of the business at different times. Like there was no part of the business that one of us hadn't touched in sort of rotation in the early days. as you grew, that becomes confusing for everyone. And so you have to delineate and be more clear about who to go to for what.
Right.
But at different times, we sort of did it all between the two of us. And I feel like that created really deep knowledge base between the two of us and a cohesion that was useful. I was never completely in the dark on what might be happening in his side of the house and vice versa. And how it went, it was great. I think what I've said is that working with your partner, at least for me, 99% of the time, it's, I think, like nirvana, the best thing you can imagine. You get to celebrate the highs together.
Or if my wife would say that. Although I'm actually working for my wife right now.
There we go. Nirvana, would you say?
That was nirvana. That's what I'm saying. I'm not sure what she's saying.
Yeah, well, you're, yeah, on air. That's what you're saying.
Exactly.
And then I think the times where the 1% of the time where things are bad for both of you, it's an extremely, extremely lonely and isolating thing. So, you know, I think it creates more intensity in the experience, but for me, way more in the direction of great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So then you sold it.
Yes.
So what did that look like? Strategic buyer. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. We,
was that always the intention or did it just kind of show up for you or how did it all happen?
It was always the intention in part, you know, perfect dovetail from the fact that ran this business with my husband. We loved the experience of working together, but we have enough humility to realize that we should end it on a high note. You know, it's not, it's not a given that that was always going to feel like a great thing. So we had always kind of figured that at the soonest point where we felt like the business could really stand on its own and had reached a level of success that it gave it sort of the fortitude to continue on in spirit, that we would look for a buyer. We wanted it to be a strategic and not a PE for a few reasons. And I think one of those reasons was just the feeling that the right strategic, I think, would be willing to carry forward some of these things that we did because we felt like they were the right things to do for our customer and our team. And it might not be the bottom line.
That's the reason to do that, it. Pretty sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, we had.
But even strategic buyers can be a little difficult depending on how big they are, I guess. Yeah.
Yes, totally. Totally. We got really lucky on that. But yes, we did intentionally run a process. We worked with an investment banker. They were fantastic. We did it at a point where we'd crossed a revenue threshold where we figured it would be, you know, at least interesting enough to a strategic buyer, but also that they felt like the business could stand on its own. Because from the conversations I'd had with other entrepreneurs who had sold to a strategic, they always had sort of a revenue mark in mind where the strategic buyer felt like the business wouldn't get just completely, like, you know, decimated by the absorption or not be able to stand on its own. Like there would be some sort of synergy there. Synergy. We love that word in the M&A world.
Exactly. 1 + 1 = 5.
Exactly. Yeah. So yes, ran a process, ended up choosing mutually a buyer named Pharmavite, and they are the owners of Nature Made, which is the biggest vitamin and supplement brand in the country. And they were the right buyer for a few reasons. One is they were super committed to quality, really high integrity business. That's always been at the core of their DNA. And cared a lot about science as well. And that was something that mattered to us for sure. And we also wanted a partner who could help kind of take that research to the next level on our products. And they have super old, longstanding retail relationships as well. Eucora had done all of our growth up to this point on e-commerce exclusively, our own website, not even through Amazon. That was extremely intentional. We were able to build a tight relationship with our customers accordingly. And that's not the case. Once you move into Omni, you have to accept just a dilution of that relationship. There's no way around it. But we always felt like we were doing a really good job of serving people who have UTIs online. But we know these people are also talking to their doctors and they're also shopping in store. And we weren't meeting those people where they were.
Touching them, yeah.
Yeah. So it was going to be the next evolution no matter what. And Pharmavite ended up being a really good partner for that. So once we joined them, we launched nationally into CVS. Now you can find Eucora in Walgreens as well. And that expansion is going to continue. And they were very committed to keeping sort of like the essence of the team in place. They wanted San Diego to remain the location where their women's health business unit was housed. And so that felt awesome for us. Yes. That the team, you know, this can all go a lot of different ways. And it was amazing that they wanted to keep the talent in place. They were in some ways acquiring Eucora for our e-commerce knowledge as well. And so they wanted that sort of brain trust to remain.
So did you have to do an earnout for a couple of years or?
We had Yes, about 10% of the deal remained in milestones to hit over the last 18 months that we were with the business.
And it can always be a challenge for the entrepreneur where you're running your own ship and all of a sudden like, oh.
Oh, sure. There was plenty of challenge in that. Yeah. I think
here's our accounting system. It starts with that.
The accounting was really tough. I think that we started with a hypothesis that there would be pieces of the business that it would make sense for Pharmavite to own. Finance and operations were kind of the obvious ones, as well as science and R&D. And that makes good sense even still when you think about it. They had deep expertise in these areas, but the difference in company size made it so that the speed and complexity with which they worked just like completely hamstrung. Our very small team. So a lot of brain damage there for everybody, but you know, there's hours I wish I could get back and my team does too. But the important thing is that their leadership was like extremely flexible and humble about it all. Like we would get back together. Everyone would concede that something was not working and it was different than what we thought it would be. And I don't think that's how that often goes. No. So
that was great. It was awesome. Yes. The acquirers come in and very kind of cocky and egos and
yes,
we're here, we bought you, this is the dealy, and
exactly.
I've been around a fair amount of M&A. I know what that looks like. Yeah. I've been on both sides of that equation.
Yes. So I think in the scheme of things at all, it was as good of partners as we could have asked for.
So all in, what's like the one big piece of advice you would give somebody who listen to this whole story? Say, man, that sounds great. And I hope my product goes this whole route. What would you give for one big thought on what you should do? And maybe one thing, definitely don't do this.
Just one.
The big one.
It seems so contrived to say it, but like there needs to be a reason for your product to exist, especially in the consumer space. I find this to be like a piece of advice that often just doesn't get implemented. No one was approaching UTIs the way we were approaching them. Since there's been a number of copycat. So kind of
what's your unique value proposition?
Exactly. And do you really in your heart think this product needs to exist? Or are you kind of just doing a small incremental improvement on something that is already in the marketplace? If you are, you might find some success, but it'll really be a race to the bottom. Maybe it works out for you, but I wouldn't be, I feel like the arc that I described in part because so much of what was possible for us was possible because there was limited competition in this realm. We've, I think, since created a niche. There's now competition in the market. Plenty of companies that are selling almost the exact same formula as Eucora, but didn't matter. Eucora was able to get there first because we were doing something that needed to happen for people. And so just be really honest with yourself of sort of, is this actually accretive to people's lives and the landscape that exists now?
Right. And you got that because you experienced it. You had that passion for it and saw the need. And as it was working for you, it was like, okay, this can work for other people. And now we got a story to tell.
Right.
And then it fueled itself, right? All the customers are saying, yes, this is something we really need. So
yes.
So what's the afterlife look like? What are you up to?
Afterlife is different. We are starting a business restaurant or a coffee shop restaurant in Sunset Cliffs. Looking forward to that. Very, very different taste of entrepreneurship, which is fun. And I'm doing some consulting, some advising for different brands in the consumer health space on the board of a local nonprofit. It's been really fun. Helped start it. It's been fun to sort of take the entrepreneurial journey in the nonprofit space versus the for-profit space and compare how that all happens. It's been interesting.
Yeah,
for sure.
I'm seeing that from my side of the world too, because my wife runs a nonprofit. So it's kind of what that looks like. It's different for sure.
Yes. So yeah, staying busy and in a different way. Flow of life is very different. Also have a 9-month-old daughter. So that
changes things a little bit.
Really changes things. Yes.
That's a whole nother project.
Mm-hmm. I was up like 5 times last night. I've been really grateful to string together any sentences today at all.
I never would have guessed. You're doing great.
Thank you. So yes, it's a different flow of life, but a very, very rich time. I'm very excited.
So what's the big idea? So I always like to end the podcast with like, if people didn't remember anything, what's the one thing you want them to remember? And it could be about anything, about what we talked about or anything. Your call.
I think the thing to remember is that it should feel value aligned. Like if you're going to give so much of your time to something, there's a way for it to feel compatible with who you are. And that isn't always going to be that, you know, you're necessarily working at a nonprofit that has exactly the mission that you've pictured being able to make an impact on. But there's, I think, so many ways to create conscious capitalism. I mean, to be on theme here. And so I feel like just trust that litmus test and look for the things that are or are not compatible with your ideals. And I think you can find it in all these different creative ways.
Jenna, thank you for coming in today. Love the story. I love your passion for it all. And yeah, I can see why you were successful.
Thank you.
Good job.
Thanks for having me.
And for changing a lot of people's lives.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been in my honor of lifetime. It's been really, really fun.
And we're just getting started. Now you're in round two.
Yeah, who knows?
The bar has been set. Now you gotta take it up a notch. Just saying.
True. Having a moment of rest.
Of course, you got that baby though. So that might be the next big milestone. Well, that's our show for today. And if you enjoyed it, please subscribe, comment, and most importantly, share the podcast with a friend. Again, special thanks to our collaborative community of San Diego business organizations, the Better Business Bureau, Conscious Capitalism, Be Local, Business for Good, and Cause San Diego, who are all using the influence of business to positively impact our very own community of San Diego. I'm Jeff Blanton from Jailbreak Leadership saying, until next time, go do what you do. Go do what you do best, where we're all counting on you.